Which one?
The,
this?
Yeah.
Yeah, but just by looking at it, because you know that sine goes between plus minus 1, so the maximum velocity has to be that value there.
Okay.
Yep, you can also, basically, like from this equation, from that equation, from this equation, there are lots of ways of getting what the maximum velocity is. More questions?
I accidentally punched 2 in front of that, and I totally didn't mean to do that. So I wrote that answer down instead of what it would have been if it was 1.6.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I can do about it. We'll see. Okay, so who has taken the lab practical already? Shout out some advice for the people who haven't. Yes.
Lab doesn't like that.
Yes. So scientific notation, you got to be able to rewrite it in a way that Excel and WAP will accept, which is with the E notation.
Figure out how to linearize a curve, because I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, this word linearize curve, what it means is select scales so that you get so that what is a curve looks like a straight line. Other advice? My generic advice, based on what people have sent to me as suggestions, is to look at your units. Lots of people have problems with units.
When you're linearizing a curve, is that on WAP when you do like the power, the linear, and those?
No. So that's at the it just has to do with plotting.
Okay.
And if you've looked, there are typically 3 options for scales for Y and 3 options for scales for X. And by choosing the right button, what is a curve will look like a straight line. So like log paper makes power laws look like straight lines. Exponential curves look straight on semi-log paper. Okay, so y'all should have signed up for one of these guys. Post-test, so just exactly what we did at the beginning, we're gonna do it again. So that'll count like a lab this time as opposed to 20 points no matter what you get. I'll put a link to it on our page. We have probably now covered everything that's on the post-test. But the last time that you can click grade me on that online thing is the Tuesday after our final at 11:59.
Is that going to be like the pretest where you can go back and change your answer?
Oh, you mean to do it repeatedly? I don't think it would. So I guess the answer is yes, but you don't get any answers back. So I don't see why you would change your answers.
Because if you change the answer, your score decreases. That means you have that one right.
But you don't get the score back, I think. I think it just says thanks. So the one thing it does do is it tells you if you left something blank. So that's the reason people usually retake it, to fill in a blank that they left.
Where is the post-test found?
I'll make a link for it from our webpage.
So that's your next Tuesday or the final?
Let's do the Tuesday after our final. I think it's a reasonable thing to do before your final is kind of, it's a multiple choice test, so it's not a perfect match. It's not even a very good match to what we do in class, but it's at least something. And it might give you some ideas of what you don't really remember. So people have been emailing me about times that they can't take the final, like on Monday, and that's okay. We can have an alternative time. And currently, people are telling me Tuesday is a good time for the alternative time. So if you think you can't make either of the Monday times, you should email me and we'll try and work out a time for, you know, a half dozen people or so to take it some other time. I think they are 8 and 3:30, but I'm
go to either one.
And you can go to either one.
Where will that be?
Here. Going, gone? Okay, so we've got kind of one big leftover topic from chapter 13, and that's waves. And it's kind of hard to demonstrate waves in the classroom because we need something that's pretty big. But the idea is we're thinking about things kind of like this, kind of like water waves that are propagating over the ocean. And I think the reason we're talking about simple harmonic motion is that the graphs look similar. That is to say, this has been a graph of position versus time, but instead let's think of this as a graph of the surface of water. So at this particular location, there's a top of a wave. At this particular location, there's a bottom of a wave. And typically what happens, of course, is these waves actually move with time. So we're going to be interested in the wave speed. And that's going to be different for different sorts of material. And we're going to have some parameters that describe these waves. One obvious one is the amplitude. How high are the waves? So incidentally, if they talk about the waves on Lake Superior being 7 feet tall, they're actually meaning that. They're meaning peak to trough. But what we mean by amplitude is the distance from the equilibrium point to the top or the equilibrium point to the bottom of a wave. We can still talk about the period of a wave, just as we've talked about it before. How long does it take for a wave to go through a cycle? That is to say, at a particular location, you've got a peak. How long do you have to wait for another peak to occur? And if we've got a period, we've got a frequency. How many cycles per second of the wave are going by the end of the dock? So these quantities all mean pretty much the same thing in the context of a wave as they meant in the context of simple harmonic motion. The one thing that's brand new is the wavelength, usually denoted by the Greek letter lambda. And the wavelength is how far it is, say, from troughs or peaks or from equivalent zero spots. All of those things should be the same. How big is a cycle in meters? And if you think about it, if a wave moves one cycle in one period, it must be that the wave speed is the wavelength divided by the period. And since the frequency is 1 over the period, it must be that the wavelength times the frequency equals the wave speed. Okay, so nothing super complicated about that. We're going to run into lots of different waves. We're going to have sound waves, light waves, water waves, waves on strings, all of those sorts of possibilities. And what we'd like is some way of predicting what the wave speed is. So, yep.
So there's no difference between wavelength and period?
Oh, there's a huge difference between wavelength and period. So wavelength is measured in meters. So the same graph a moment ago, this was the time axis, but now I'm taking a photograph of a wave. So this is now space. So wavelength is the distance between two peaks and troughs. Period is still a time. Sitting at one location, how long does it take for the wave to go through one full cycle? More questions?
What's the y-axis?
So the y-axis could be lots of different things, but it might, for example, be the height of the water. If this were a sound wave, it might be atmospheric pressure. If this were a light wave, it might be the electric field. So whatever is waving, whatever is changing in spatial location, that's what would be on the y-axis. So if we're thinking water waves, the depth of water, basically, or the height of water. So we've got one wave in particular in this chapter to deal with, and that's waves on tight strings. So if we have a string that is tied between two locations and it has a tension in it, you can twang that string. And you can send a wave going, say as a pulse, up and down that string. And we could show that the velocity of that wave depends on the tension and the mass of the string. But not literally the mass of the string, because obviously a longer string under the same tension is going to have exactly the same wave speed. So what we have in the denominator is the mass per length. And the book denotes the mass per length as the Greek letter mu. So if we had such a string, if we sent this wave down, it's going to reflect off of this boundary. And it turns out it's going to reflect inverted. So it's going to come back kind of like that. So if we're thinking about something like a violin string, we're going to have these pulses going back and forth and back and forth on that taut string. The higher the tension, the faster the wave moves, the more times it's going to be bouncing in those walls. And it's the bouncing into the sound post, in particular for a violin, that's making the sound that we hear. So the higher the frequency of the sound, it's going to correspond to the higher tension in the violin string. And you also know, if you've looked at strings, that thick strings, strings that have a lot of mass per length, those are going to be the bass notes.
With the violin example, is that still like bowing, or if you're just plucking a string?
So yes. So it turns out if you look at bowing in particular, you think that something kind of continuous is happening, but microscopically what's happening is actually just a series of picks. That microscopically I don't know how I can draw this very well. I can't draw it very well. So if this is the string and this is the bow, what's happening is the bow holds it for a second and then releases it, and then grabs it for a second and then releases it. So it really is just a series of plucks. More questions? Okay, so let's take a look at some of the problems. Now, we've got this really neat device, which I didn't show you last time. I'm sure you'll be excited by it. So you remember we said that circular motion projected was simple harmonic motion. So instead of me drawing on the board, I can turn this crank. Cool. I don't know. So the main point, of course, is that this is the projection of circular motion, and it's just going back and forth while the thing's going around. And that was the basis for all of our calculations on simple harmonic motion. Okay, so Well, let me spend a second, I guess, on this word transverse. Longitudinal. So a transverse wave is kind of what I've been describing before, where the actual motion of the particle is up and down, whereas the wave itself is going horizontally. It turns out that that's not, for example, how sound works. For a sound wave, which is the topic of the next chapter, it turns out that the air is actually vibrating in the same direction that the sound is going. If you think about a wave on something like a slinky, there we have a compression, say, of the slinky, and that's going to be moving along. So it's not an important difference. A transverse wave is where the actual motion is perpendicular to the direction of propagation, and a longitudinal wave is a wave where the actual motion is in the actual motion of the particles is in the same direction as the motion. Okay, so here we have five crests that pass a given point every 14 seconds. So pretty clearly then, the frequency, which is the number of cycles per second, So we've got five cycles that are going by in 14 seconds. So we can figure out what the frequency is pretty easily, just 5 divided by 14. And we get 0.357 hertz. And they say that the distance between two successive minimums, which is exactly a wavelength, is 2.76 meters. So of course, we multiply these two together. The frequency times the wavelength is going to give us the velocity. So your basic plug and chug. So I get basically 0.986 meters per second. And you can check out the units, of course. The wavelength is in meters, and the frequency was in cycles per second. So we're going to get meters per second for our answer. Okay, so this is basically the same sort of problem with a slightly different take on it. So we see that there are ripples on a pond that go through 2 cycles per second, and the wavelength is 8.5 centimeters, and the cork is 10 meters from shore. How long does it take the ripples to reach the shore? So the last part of the question is your old distance is equal to velocity times time sort of problem. And in this particular case, we want to calculate the time. So the time is going to be the distance, the 10 meters, divided by the wave speed. The wave speed we can calculate because we know the wave speed is the frequency times the wavelength. So the frequency times the wavelength, we've got 2 cycles per second, so that's a frequency of 2 hertz, and the wavelength is 8 centimeters, 0.085 meters. So we've got a wave velocity that is 0.17 meters per second. So this time is going to be the 10 meters divided by the velocity. So about a minute, 59 seconds. Yeah, 2 cycles per second, right? So 2 hertz. So here we have ocean waves that are moving east at 4 meters per second with a distance of 20 meters between the crests. With what frequency do the wave fronts hit the front of the boat? So here they tell us the velocity, and they tell us the wavelength, and we're supposed to calculate the frequency, right? So it's another pretty straightforward plug and chug. We know that the velocity is the frequency times the wavelength. They tell us the velocity is 4 meters a second. They tell us that the wavelength is 20 meters. So the frequency is going to be the velocity divided by the wavelength. So we have 4 divided by 20, which is 1/5, 0.2 seconds, 0.2 hertz. Okay, so the second part of the question is actually trickier. So it says, if the boat is moving, the waves are going to hit at a different rate. So let's try and see how that's going to work out. Okay, so kind of a lousy sort of drawing. Right, so here's our boat, and these guys are going to be approaching each other. So it's not going to take quite so long before we hit two of these crests. How long is it actually going to take? What's going to be the frequency of hits if the boat is plowing in the direction that the waves are moving? Well, if we follow one cycle, so if the boat is here, in a time t, the boat is going to have moved velocity of boat times t. And the wave is going to have moved the velocity of the wave times t. And if they meet, then this distance has to add up to a wavelength. So we start the boat at one peak, it's moving forward, the other one is moving forward. The time for them to meet, given that they're separated by a wavelength, has to satisfy this equation, that the velocity of the water times that time plus the velocity of the boat plus that times that time has to add up to a wavelength. So if we kind of rearrange this equation, we've got the velocity of the wave plus the velocity of the boat times that time has to add up to a wavelength. And remember, they're asking us for the frequency, so we actually want to solve for 1 over time. So let's bring this time down to the other side of the equation. And let's bring the lambda down. So what we've got is the wave was moving at 4 meters a second. The boat was moving at 1 meter per second. The wavelength is 20 meters. So we've got 5 divided by 20, 0.25 hertz. Okay, so if the boat is plowing towards the wave, we're going to have a higher frequency of these sorts of collisions. If the reverse is the case, so what happens if the boat is going in the same direction that the waves are going to move? So then the picture has to change. Well, let me move my boat so that it's actually starting at the top of one wave. Okay, so here's kind of the starting situation. In the future, this wave is going to be moving fast this way, and the boat is going to be moving fast that way. So at some future time, the boat is going to have moved its velocity times time, and the wave is going to have moved this larger distance that is equal to the wave velocity times time. But it's this distance that's a wavelength. So it must be that the velocity of the wave times t minus the velocity of the boat times t, that has to equal the wavelength, right? This is the wavelength. This is the distance that the wave moved. The boat moved that distance. We need to subtract that off to get a wavelength. So if we rearrange this one the way we did the other one, and remember that we're looking for 1 over the period, so under these circumstances, the frequency would be 4 minus 1 divided by 20. So we're going to have 3/20, which I can't do in my head. I must have made a mistake. I should have been able to do that in my head. So we have a lower frequency if we're moving away from the, moving in the same direction that the wave is moving. So this is a famous effect that's called the Doppler effect. And so what we've seen is that if we're moving towards the source, the frequency is higher. And in fact, it's given by this equation, the velocity of the wave plus the velocity of the boat divided by a wavelength. Incidentally, we can make this equation maybe look a little bit fancier if we pull out, factor out the velocity of the wave. So now I have the ratio of the velocity of the boat to the velocity of the water wave. basically its Mach number, how fast it's going compared to the local speed. And this thing here is the frequency that we would normally have. So the frequency is upshifted from the normal frequency according to the velocity of the moving object divided by the wave speed. And we could rearrange this thing for the other possibility. If we're moving along with the wave, then quite naturally the frequency is going to be downshifted like that. So if the receiver is moving, the frequency they're going to hear is different from the frequency that was emitted. If you think about it, the same thing is going to apply if the source is moving. So you can imagine, for example, a little insect or something that's dancing along the water, and every second or so it sticks its foot in the water. So here's where it stuck its foot in the water, but this is in the future, so that wave has moved out to that sort of location. A little bit later, it stuck its foot in its water, it stuck its foot in the water there, and so we're going to have another circle that surrounds that point, and so it goes. And because the insect is moving in this direction, you can see that the wavelength is going to be shorter on the side that it's approaching, and the wavelength is going to be longer on the side that it's receding from it. Okay, so if we have a case where the source and the receiver are approaching each other, that would be the case if we were here with the insect, where we're talking about the first possibility with the boat, the frequency is shifted up compared to what it would be normally. If we have a situation with the insect, if we were here and the insect is moving away from us, or if we have the boat that's moving along the wave, either of those circumstances, then we're going to have a frequency that's shifted down from what's normal. Okay. Doppler. So Doppler literally did this by putting an orchestra on a railroad car, right? So trains were considered relatively fast moving objects in the 1850s. And he asked them to play an A, and sitting alongside the tracks, you didn't hear an A. And if you've ever hitchhiked, you've had exactly the same phenomena, right? As the car approaches, you hear a high pitch note, and as it moves away from you, you hear a low pitch note. Yeah, I won't even try. Go out and hitchhike. Or don't hitchhike, actually. Go have your brother hitchhike and have them tell you what it sounds like. Questions? Okay, so these were all pretty generic problems with waves. The Doppler effect affects sound, light, water waves, anything where we have moving sources and or moving receivers. So here we're dealing with problems that are specific to these waves on the string. Right? So we kind of just have two equations for this class. We've got that one and we've got this one. So these are the other sorts of problems we can have. So this is a basic plug and chug. They tell us what the mass per length is of the string. They tell us what the tension is, and we're supposed to find the speed. Right? So what could be easier than that? We're told that the velocity is the square root of the tension divided by the mass per length, which the book denotes by mu. So we've got a square root of the tension, 1350 newtons, and we're dividing by a mass per length, that is 0.005 kilograms per unit, per meter. Well, I'll spend a second to think about the units. So underneath the radical, we've got newtons, which are kilograms meters per second squared. And we're dividing that by kilograms per meter. So the kilograms are going to go away. We have meters in the denominator of the denominator. So that's going to come upstairs. So underneath the radical, we've got meters squared per second squared, which is exactly what we need if we're going to get out meters per second. So otherwise, it's just straightforward plugging and chugging. So we got 1350, 0.005, take the square root, and I get basically 520 meters per second. Okay. If we tighten that piano string, then the tension increases, the velocity increases, the number of hits per second are therefore going to increase, and therefore the frequency of the note you're going to get is going to increase. If we replace that piano string with one that weighs more per length, we're going to get a slower velocity and a lower frequency for the resulting note. So here's a problem that is asking us to kind of do a little bit more with this equation. What they say is we've got a string that is 50 centimeters long and has a particular mass, and they tell us that the wave speed is 5 meters per second. They don't tell us what the tension is. We've got a second string that has the same length but half the mass. If the two strings are under the same tension, what's the wave speed along the second string? And the long way around to work this problem would be we could calculate the mass per length, convert it to kilograms per meter. We could use the velocity and the mass per length to calculate the tension. We could plug the tension back into the first equation with half the mass per length and calculate the velocity. But when we have things that are constant, think the gas equation. Often it was faster to work that as a P1 V1 over T1 equals V2 T2 over T2. So that's kind of the plan. Let's convert our equation into something that isn't going to require quite so much work. So what's constant is the tension. So let's take our equation and focus on the tension. So to get the tension by itself, I want to square this equation. And then I can say that V squared times mu is equal to the tension. And the tension is the same in both of these strings. So it must be that the velocity squared times the mass per length has to be a constant. So they're asking us for what's the speed of the wave in the second string. So V2 squared is going to be V1 squared, the ratio of the mu's. And the velocity, if I take the square root of this equation, the velocity in the second circumstance is going to be the velocity of the first times the ratio of the mu's. So we don't have to do any unit conversion because we've got mu over mu. So we don't have to bother to convert that into kilograms per meter. We can just go with those units because they'll cancel out. So we know that the original velocity was 5 meters per second. And we know that the second string weighs half as much as the first one. So this is going to be 5 times the square root of 2. So 707. So if you have an equation where something's constant and they're asking you kind of how the situation changes things, just like the ideal gas law, it's often advantageous to rearrange it into know, something like this. So they tell us that steel has an elastic limit of 2.7 billion pascals. So you remember elastic, probably might remember that elastic limit came in the context of Young's modulus, right, where we said that the change in length divided by the length was the stress divided by Young's modulus. So what we have here is a stress, a force per area, and if we apply more force per area to this piece of wire, it's going to basically break. And they also tell us the density of steel, 7,860,000 kilograms per cubic meter. And we're supposed to figure out what the speed is that pulses are going to travel through this wire. Well, this looks like kind of a funny question. They didn't tell us the size of the wire, right? And obviously, if it's a thicker wire, it's going to have more mass per length. So are things going to come out kind of in the wash or not? Well, they must, since it's a problem. So the only thing we can do is to assume some radius of the wire and then hope for the best that, in fact, we don't need it in the end. I don't see another alternative. So here's my wire. I'm going to put a stress on this wire that is this 2.7 billion pascals. And you remember that the stress was the force divided by the area. So the actual force, the tension, is going to be the stress times the area, the cross-sectional area of the wire. And that, since it's a circle, is going to be pi r squared. Okay, so I know the t part of the equation. What is the mass per length? Well, if I have a length L of this wire, the volume of that wire, the volume of a cylinder, is the cross-sectional area times the length. And we know the mass of this wire is the density times the volume. So the mass per length, which the book denotes with mu, that's going to be just rho pi r squared. So I can put my value for mu in there. I can put my value for t in there. And I think you can see we're going to get a cancellation of the radiuses, that the actual radius of the wire isn't going to matter. Well, let's see how that works out. So what we've got is the stress, 2.7 times 10 to the 9th pascals, times the area, that's the tension, and the mass per length is the density times pi r squared. So the pi r squareds disappear, and the claim is that the velocity is just the elastic stress divided by the mass per unit length. That if I'm stretching the wire as much as possible, the velocity doesn't depend on how fat the wire is. The fatter the wire, the more I have to pull it. But in the end, I'm going to have the same velocity. Let's check out our units. So the stress was in pascals, and that's a newton per meter squared. And the density was in kilograms per cubic meter. So you can see I've got two meters in the denominator of the numerator and 3 in the denominator of the denominator. So if I bring those 3 upstairs, I'm going to get a Newton meter divided by a kilogram. And at this point, we can remember that a Newton is a kilogram meter per second squared. So the kilograms are going to go away. And under the radical, we're going to have meters squared per second squared, which is exactly what we need for a velocity. Okay, so what's the numerical answer? So we've got 2.7 times 10 to the ninth pascals, and we've got 7.86 times 10 to the third kilograms per cubic meter for the density. And we get a velocity that isn't that much bigger than what we've been talking about, 586 meters per second. That's comparable to the velocity of sound. Questions? So let's go back to something that we talked about at the beginning of the last lecture. So you remember that they don't really make very good problems, so I guess I wouldn't worry about this occurring on an exam. But the claim was that if we understood how springs work, we could think about almost any other oscillation as being a version of a spring with just an effective spring constant and an effective mass. So here we have something, it's called a torsional pendulum. So it's not, I'm not trying to make it swing back and forth, just twist. So these things actually make pretty good clock mechanisms because the twist will go on for quite a long time because there's relatively little air resistance as it's going back and forth. So this is not at all back and forth motion. This is angular motion. Can we use the usual sort of formulas to figure out what the period of oscillation is? So you remember that the spring, the formula for the period, I don't think I bothered to write it over there. The period is the square root of m over k times 2 pi, right? 2 pi over omega is maybe a better way of remembering it. So we have to figure out what plays the role of m and what plays the role of k. And we had two major ways of doing this. We could talk about it in terms of energy, or we could talk about it in terms of forces. And we can do it for both ways for this particular one. So in terms of forces, we had the mass times the acceleration was minus kx. In terms of energy, we had the energy was 1/2 mv squared, the kinetic energy, plus the potential energy. So in terms of the kinetic energy of rotation, that's 1/2 I omega squared. So what I need to know if I'm going to try and use this sort of formula is what's the potential energy that's in a twisted wire. And it turns out that twisted wires work pretty much exactly the same as springs. So with a spring, the force was minus kx. If you twist something, we're talking about torques now, the torque is minus some constant, I'll just call it k, times the amount of angle you've twisted it. The more you twist it, the more it's going to fight. And there's a linear relationship between these two. Okay, and just as the potential energy was 1/2 kx squared, the potential energy for this setup is going to be 1/2 this constant times theta squared. So if we think about it in terms of energy, we're going to have the kinetic energy of rotation, the I of this rotating object, plus 1/2 this thing that's like a spring constant, right? Rotate the thing by 30 degrees and see what the corresponding torque is, times theta squared. And I hope you can see that I is going to play the role of mass. And this thing, which is often denoted by a kappa as opposed to a k, is going to play the role of the spring constant. So it must be, for this thing, the period is going to be I divided by k. Right, so different moments of inertia, we could figure out what the period is, different sorts of wires that would have different restoring constants, could figure out the corresponding period. Okay, questions? Well, let's call it quits early for once.
Can I ask you a question about my quiz? Could you grab it?
So it looked like you hadn't completed it. So at this point, my first comment is there are more than 400 points that we have. So any individual quiz isn't going to make a big difference.
I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't get enough sleep last night, so I think I just, I don't know. But then I was wondering, for the frequency, because if one cycle, that was 0.6, and that's what I was thinking. But then if it's cycle per second,